And we're holding on page 56 in Yuma, about three or four lines from the bottom of the page, middle of our stomach, Gimel. We were learning about the Urim V'Tumim and how they worked. We're going to really talk about today, but what was the procedure for asking them and the rules you need to know before you ask them. For us nowadays, in a way, it may be easier to understand this Gemara than it would in olden times. You can think of the Urim V'Tumim as the Havdil like a computer. You have the Chas V'Shalom to use the same expression, but they have the expression computerese, garbage in, garbage out. You ask the wrong thing, you're going to get the wrong answer. And here it is over here also. You got to know what to ask and how to ask it. So now the Gemara continues. This is a long braisa that's describing the procedure with the Urim V'Tumim. The Apap Now, even though we sometimes find that what a Novi says is retracted, we know that if a Novi says in Nevuah that something bad is going to happen, it's not necessarily Hashem can be Erech HaPayim, the people can be Tshuva, etc. Gzeiras Urim V'Tumim Ein Chazeres. But the rule, whatever it said, whatever the Urim V'Tumim says is going to happen, that never gets retracted. It's always going to happen exactly the way it says. Shenemba B'Mishpat Urim, as the Pasuk describes, the Pasuk calls it the judgment of the Urim. So it's like a judgment that doesn't get reversed. Now why Taka should that be so? What happens if the people do Tshuva? So the Abba Benel, actually on the Pesukim, says a reason because he says the Urim V'Tumim is meant for short-term predictions. You don't ask the Urim V'Tumim what's going to be a long time from now. You ask it, should we go to war, etc., that kind of thing. So not very likely that from when they ask the Urim V'Tumim till they actually go to war, there's going to be such a turnover that the Eidishter will change the Gzera. It doesn't really seem, it seems a little hard to understand, because we say, after all, a person can do Tshuva B'Shaita Chodo U'Beriga Chodo. In one moment, a person can transform himself in Akotza L'Akotza, but that's how the Abba Benel explains it. Then Yehoyada gives a different reason. He says because the whole concept of how the Urim V'Tumim works is a nes. The Eidishter doesn't do a nes for nothing. So if he were to give an answer with Bederach nes with the Urim V'Tumim, and then it doesn't come true, then it would be that he did a nes for nothing. And therefore, the Lomanik Shemam Urim V'Tumim. So why are they called Urim V'Tumim? Urim Shem Irim Es Divrehem. They're called Urim because they light up their words. Now Rashi says it doesn't mean light up as in the stones light up. We are going to talk about soon how exactly the Kohen Gadol would see the message on the Choshen. But Rashi just learns Me'irim means they clearly state what their answer is. And Tumim Shem Ashlumim LeDivrehem is they're called Tumim Meloshin Tam Meloshin Complete because their words are complete and perfect. Like we said, the Gzera never goes back. Now, Ritzvah gives a different explanation over here, and he says that they're called Urim and Tumim respectively, in the sense that you had to have their word Urim in that the letters light up, and that Tumim and that as the Gemara is going to say soon, they would stick out of the Choshen, the Kohen Gadol would see them sticking out, and then he needs to know how to put the letters in the right order. That's Tumim. So according to him, those are two different parts of how it actually works. The Ritva also mentions over here in this connection, you have a number of different explanations from the Ritva that I brought over here. He also mentions in this connection the stones on the Choshen. Now we know you have stones on the Ephod. We know you have the 12 stones on the Choshen, each with the name of a Shevet. You also had the names of the Shvatim on the two stones of the Ephod, six on each stone. It's mashma from the way that the Ritva says it, that those factored into it as well, that the message would come not only on the Choshen, but also on the stones of the Ephod. On the two shoulder straps of the Ephod. Most other Rishonim don't learn that way. They just it would only be the stones on the Choshen. The Im Toimah. Now you're going to ask if the Urim V'Tumim always gives a reliable answer. But give us Binyamin if they malo hishlimu. Then why by Givas Binyamin? Why when they went to war against Giva for the whole story of the Pelegish B'Giva? Why did the answer not work out? So we have to review a little bit what happened in the Pesukim over there. So after you have the whole story of Pelegish Begiva, how she was raped and assaulted and killed, etc. So everybody's outraged and they're going to war against Shevet Binyamin. They ask the Urim V'Tumim, and they ask him who should go up first, who should lead the battle. And Hashem says Yehuda. So they go and they fight against Binyamin. 22,000 soldiers from the other Shevatim are killed. They try again the next day. They ask, should we continue to go to war against Binyamin? Hashem says, yes, go ahead. And they go, and the next day, 18,000 more soldiers are killed. Then they're going to pieces. They're fasting. They're davening or whatever. Then they ask the Umm Batum, and they're crying. They ask the Umm Batum, should we continue going to war or should we stop? And Hashem says, go, and I'm going to give them over into your hand. And sure enough, the third day, they fight against Shevet Binyamin, and they wipe out almost the entire Shevet. So what happened the first two times then? On the face of it, if the Umm Batum always gives a reliable answer, how is it that on the first 2 days, they lost 40,000 men? So actually, there's a Gemara in Shavuos where the Gemara is discussing over there which names of Hashem that are mentioned. We have always the question, we have the name Elikim. Does it refer to Hashem or Lahavdol? Does it refer to Avodah Zarah? So the Gemara discusses that in Shavuos, and it mentions that so in connection with this whole story of Giva, you have several times, by Yishalu by Elikim, or even by Yishalu by Hashem, Rabbi Eliezer learns, because of this question, the first two times they didn't ask the genuine Urim Batumim. They actually asked something of Avodah Zarah, he learns. And therefore he learns that Elikim, and maybe even the Shem Havaya over there, refers to, for example, Pesel Micha. Micha over there is, after all, claiming that his statue is meant to represent the power of Hashem, and it has an ephod and teraphim in connection with it. So he learns the first two times they're asking that. No wonder they got an answer that didn't work out. Rabbi Yeshua tells him no, as the Gemara is going to answer over here, they asked the question the wrong way the first two times. But you have Bechlau, there are Rishonim who learn, besides for the Choshen that was made originally by Moshe Rabbeinu, and as the Ritva is saying over here, you have the name of Hashem that was put between the folds of it that made it work, there are Rishonim who learn that there were other, on the side of Kedusha, there were other ephods and choshens as well that were available for people to be able to use, because the same way as Hashem told Moshe the secret of how to write that Shema Mefurish to make the choshen work, the same way there were people in that time who also had this idea of how to do that, and they were also able to make choshens like that would work in the same way Mitzad Kedusha. Then you also have people who would make the Mitzad HaTumah. You find in a few places in Nach, you find where they had ephods that were used as things involved with Avodah Zarah. So in that case, so Rabbi Eliezer is saying over there that the first two times they asked one of those. And only the third time did they finally go and ask the genuine one, or one of the genuine ones at least. Rabbi Yeshua says that no, and the Gemara is saying over here, the Brice over here is following his opinion. The problem was, Hem Shalei Bichanu Im Linsoyach Im Linatseach. Because the first two times they didn't think to ask whether they're asking if they should go to war, but they're not asking, are we going to win the war? The first time they're Bechlau not even asking if they should go to war. The first time they're just saying who should go first. In other words, it's a given we're going to war. Who should lead the battle? And Elish is answering through the Urim Batumim. Well, you know, Yehuda always goes first. Fine, you're asking the wrong question, you're going to get the wrong answer. The second time they asked, should we go? But they didn't think to ask, should we hold back? So fine, you want to go, go because you have to hate. And I'm not going to tell you what's going to actually happen. The third time, they're finally realizing to ask whether they should go or whether they should not go. In other words, are they going to win or are they going to lose? Now, the Elish tells them, go and tomorrow you'll win. The third time they finally got, they finally realized to ask the question correctly. Then the Urim Batumim agreed with what they wanted and told them the correct forecast that they are going to win, which in fact they did. Shenema, as the Pesukim say, the third time when they came to ask, Ufinchas ben Elazar ben Aaron omen the fun of Bayomim Ahim, that there was the Aaron over there, and Pinchas ben Elazar was standing before the Aaron in those days, he was the Kohen Gadol, Lamer, and they asked him, Ha'osif oid, Lotzis Lavachama im Bnei Binyamin Achi, should I continue to go to war with the descendants of Binyamin, my brother, im Echdal, or should I hold back? Vayomer Hashem Alu, and Hashem says, through the Urim Batumim, go up, Kimachat Nenabi Adecha, because tomorrow I'll give them into your hands. So we see, in other words, the point is that, so according to Rabbi Eliezer Bechlau, the first two times they weren't even asking the genuine Urim Batumim, they're asking an Avodah Zarah Dikah one. So of course Pinchas is not involved. The third time they finally went and asked Pinchas. According to Rabbi Yeshua, that all three times they were asking the genuine Urim Batumim, the difference is, Maharsho explains, the first two times they had some other Kohen wear the Urim Batumim and ask him, and he didn't know to give them the instructions of how to ask the question properly. The third time they made sure that Pinchas is involved, and he knows the relevant halachas that we just discussed, and therefore he knew how to ask the question. The first two times, that's what we're saying, according to Rabbi Yeshua, and this is what this Braise is saying, they did ask the Urim Batumim all three times, just the first two times, right, they asked the question the wrong way, right. So that's the deal. It's not that the Urim Batumim gives a wrong answer, but it gives an answer to what you ask, and if you don't ask the right question, you're not going to get the right answer. like a computer in that sense. Okay. Cakes of Gnosis. How did it work? How did the Urim Betumim actually work? How did the Kohen get the message? Rabbi Yochanan says the letters would stick out. So Rashi gives an example. Let's say, for example, the word is supposed to be Aleh, go up. So then you'd have the Ayin of Shimon, the Lamed of Levi, the Hay of Yehuda would stick out. Like this, all the letters were engraved into the stones on the, not really engraved actually, because you can't use iron tools. They were all sunken under the, below the level of the face of the stone using the Shomir. So now what would happen is, B'derech Nes, each one of those sunken in letters would stick out in order, and the ones that are sticking out would form the message. Rav Shimon Levi Omer Mitztarfes, Rav Shimon Lakish Omer Mitztarfes, and Rish Lakish said they would combine together. Meaning, in other words, so according to Rish Lakish, the way Rashi learns, they would actually move from their places and form a complete word. That's according to, and Maharsho adds also, so then obviously according to Rish Lakish, that Mitztarfes means they come out in the correct order. According to Rav Yochanan, that Boltus, they only stick out very well. In Rashi's example, they happen to be in the right order. Ayin from Shimon, Lamed from Levi, Hey from Yehuda. What happens if they're out of order? So for that, Maharsho says they would stick out one after the other. Each one, and that way the message could be read in order. So for example, again, you don't have to have the ayin, so you don't have to have so you could have, for example, the message could be spelled out using different letters from all over the Choshen, and each one would stick out in turn, and that would tell them the order in which to say it. That's the point of Rashi. The Ritva talks about over here that no, what it is that actually, again, part of the fact of why it's called Urim Betumim, the double name, is because they would light up, but then they have to be combined. The Kohen had to have Ruach HaKodesh to know how to combine the letters properly, meaning that they would all light up at once, and then the Kohen Gadol needs to know how to arrange the letters in the correct order. Which then, according to him, it comes out that Rish Lakish and Rabbi Yochanan are not really arguing per se, they're describing two different stages in how it works. There is a very famous explanation they bring from the Vilna Gaon in that connection that explains that he uses that to explain the story with Eli and Chana. So Chana is going over there and davening for a child, and Eli the Shikoda, and Eli sees her standing over there, and he thinks she's drunk, and he starts yelling at her, and she tells him, "No, I'm davening for a child," and he says, "You're right, I was choshed to shade him, I'm asking you mechila, and I'm giving you a bracha." What happened over here that he misunderstood her in the first place? So the Vilna Gaon brings a verdict based on this. He asked the Choshen, he asked the Urim Betumim, what's the story with this woman? And the letters that lit up for him were Hey, Chof, Resh, and Shin. Now he rearranged those, you have to rearrange them, that doesn't spell out a word. He rearranged it to spell out Shikora. So he thought the Urim Betumim was telling him she's drunk. She's telling him Lo Yadoni. No, you don't have the proper Ruach HaKodesh, as the Gemara tells us in Brachas, that's by saying Lo Yadoni, she was hinting to him, you don't have the proper Ruach HaKodesh. It's supposed to be rearranged to spell Chof Shin Resh Hey, which can spell either Ksheira or Kisara, a woman who was of the caliber of Sarah. If you had the proper Ruach HaKodesh, you would have realized that, and you would have realized that I'm no Shikora. So that fits with what the Ritva is explaining over here, that the letters would light up all at once, and the Kohen Gadol needs to have the Ruach HaKodesh to combine them together. Then I'm right, somewhat similarly in Hilchos Klei Mikdash. There's a beautiful sikha where the Rebbe talks about the deeper idea, right, that she's davening for a child, she's davening for something that she needs, a gashmiistic need, and it's Rosh Hashanah, and Evi thinks that it's not right on this day to be davening about that, you have to be davening to Moloi Chala Olam Kula B'Chvedecha, and therefore he's accusing her of being drunk on gashmiis, and she's telling him, no, I'm davening not for myself, but that I should be able to bring Elikus into the world, and he realizes his mistake. The question is, how do you spell out a message with the Choshen, Haloiksi Behut Tzadim? There's no letter Tzadik in any of the names of the Shvatim. So if you have a message that needs to have the letter Tzadik, and we had an example yesterday where the Urim Betumim tells David, Redoif Ki Hasik Tasik Vahatzil Tatzil, where's the Tzadik? Amr of Shmuel, Rabbi Yitzchak, Avraham Yitzchak V'Yakov Ksib Sham, because on the Choshen, in addition to the names of the Shvatim, it also said Avraham Yitzchak V'Yakov. We have Machlokas, we showed him how it was written. The Gemara is going to mention also, well, wait, so Vaholi Ksiv Tess. What about there's no letter Tess either? Amr Abach Bayakov, Shivti Yeshurun Ksiv Sham. It also said the word Shivti Yeshurun. There are different Yusais among the Rishonim, whether it was Shivti Yeshurun or Shivti Ka or Shivti Yisrael or something like that, whatever. It had the word Shivti, which contains a Tess. Tosfos Hashanim points out, when you get down to it, the Gemara could have also asked the question about Ches and Kuf. Those letters aren't, and then you have four letters, Sadet, Ches, Kuf, and Tes, that are not in the names of the Shvatim. Once we answer about Yitzchak, then that takes care of the Ches and Kuf as well. Cute thing in that regard, in connection with next week's parasha, Vayichi, when we know when Yaakov wants to gathers together all the Shvatim, and he wants to tell them when the Ketz is going to be, when Mashiach is going to come, and then he can't, it was hidden away from him, so we know, the Gemara tells us, he asked them, is there maybe anybody among you who doesn't believe in Eivishtem? They all answered Shema Yisrael, and he answered Baruch Shem. So Bala Turim says a cute thing on it. He says to them, is there anybody who did Averis among you? They say, Tati, not only do we not have any Averis, but you look at the letters of our names, there's no Ches and Tes in there. The word chet, you can't even make out of the letters of our names, because there's no chet and no tes among the names of the Shvatim. And Yaakov says, that's true, but you know what? There's also, in your names, there's also missing the letters of ketz. So therefore, I'm not able to tell you the ketz. Anyway, so the point is that all four of those letters are made up by writing Avraham Yitzchak from Yaakov and writing Shivtei Yeshurun or Shivtei Ka or whatever the Gir says. Yeah. So where was it written? So you have two different opinions. The Rambam learns that the words Avraham Yitzchak Yaakov were written above the name of Reuven on his stone, on the Odem, and the Shivtei Yeshurun, or Shivtei Kor, whatever, were written underneath Binyamin's name on the last stone, on Yoshvei. On the other hand, so that's our last point of the Rambam, there is an opinion that's brought by a couple of the Rishonim, Rabbi Nebuchadnezzar brings it, the Bala Turim brings it as well, that what they did is they distributed the letters among the stones so that each stone had six letters. So Reuven, for example, they put together with Reuven the Aleph of Abraham. Shimon is also five letters, they put together with it the base of Abraham. Levi is three letters, so they put the rest of the name Resh Hemen, and so forth with the rest of them until you come to Binyamin. Binyamin's name, the first time when he's born, his name is written Mali. Most of the time, most places after that, in Tanakh, his name is usually written Chaser, without the second Yud, but the first time when he's born, it's written with both Yuds. That's how it's written on the Choshen. So that's six letters, so nothing else goes with it. So according to that, there were 72 letters on the Choshen, six per stone. Anyway, the point is they had all the letters. Then Yehoyada talks about over here, Sataka, why did the Gemara, Tess comes in the Aleph Beis before Tzadik, why did the Gemara ask about, there's no Tzadik before it asked about Tess. And he says a couple of points. First of all, there's no letter in the Aleph Beis that really resembles Tzadik. Tess, at least, you could say, but Dershak, so maybe you have a Mem, for example, looks very much like a Tess. So maybe if you need a message that has to have a Tess, then instead of a Mem could substitute for it. But Tzadik, you really don't have. Second of all, he says, the fact is, you find in a number of places in Tanakh where Yitzchak's name is written Yitzchak with a sin. We have in Tillim, for example, Ashkara Savram, Ushvasi the Yitzchak, and there are a few other places in Tanakh that way. So the Gemara was thinking, to begin with, that maybe his name, maybe the names of their obvious are written on the Choshen, but maybe not Yitzchak, but rather Yitzchak, and therefore it's saying, no, it was written with a Tzadik. So the Gemara says, Maisli, I have a contradiction. If you're telling me that the letters on the stones would stick out and they'd be in the proper order or whatever it is, according to the Shlokesh or Rabbi Yechanan, how it would work. A Braisa says, Kol Koyin Shemadaba B'Ruach HaKodesh U'Shchina Shor Olav, any Koyin who is able to speak with Ruach HaKodesh and where the Shchina rests on him, Shoylem Boy, only that kind, you can ask him the Urim B'Tumim, and we have an example. Shari Shah Sodik for Ololoi, Shal of Yosef Ole Ololoi. We have an example. Now, if Yosef had been the Kohen Gadol for quite some time, this happened during the time when David was running away from Avshalom. So Avyasa had been the Kohen Gadol for many years before that. His family had been wiped out in Noiv by Shaul, by Doeg under the instructions of Shaul. So Avyasa was the only survivor. He became the new Kohen Gadol. By this, that was before David had actually started his kingship. Then he became Kohen Gadol and he served as Kohen Gadol throughout most of the 40 years of David's kingship. Now it's 35 or 36 or so years into David's kingship. So you have, it describes over there where David is running away from Yerushalayim to get someplace safe from Avshalom. So it describes the Kohenim brought the Oren until at that point, the Oren was in the Beis Mikdash, hadn't yet been built. There was a tent for the Oren that David had set up in Yerushalayim. And so now they brought the Oren, figuring that it'll go along with David wherever he's wandering to. And then they also have the Urim B'Tumim with him. So the Pasuk says they have the Oren over there by Shanema, by Yal of Yosef. The Pasuk says of Yosef went up. So it means, in other words, that what it means is, Rashi brings from Seder Olam, what happened was, David asked of Yosser, please ask the Urim B'Tumim for me, what's the story, where should I go, what should I do, and if Yosser asks, and he doesn't get a response. So then they realized he's lost his Ruach HaKodesh. So now, instead, it was transferred to Tzadik HaKoyin, who was and so he took over as the new Kohen Gadol. Eventually, it was made more official. David tells Shlomo before he passes away, after the Parshas Vayechi, that of Yosser has to be, I don't think he mentions of Yosser over there, but you need Ruach HaKodesh. That's what we're saying. And that's the question. If the letters stick out and the letters go in the correct order, what do you need Ruach? And the letters stick out, so what do you need Ruach HaKodesh in order to interpret it? That's the question. So anyway, the point is of Yosser. After David passed away, then Shlomo tells of Yosser, you were involved in Adoni Yahu's rebellion, so you are demoted permanently as Kohen Gadol. You go to your city of Anosis, and Tzadik will take over as the exclusive Kohen Gadol. The point was, though, that now we're saying, so a couple of years before that already, Tzadik had gained the Ruach HaKodesh, that of Yosser lost, and therefore Tzadik is now the one who's able to wear the Urim V'Tumim and to be asked in. So we see you need Ruach HaKodesh. This was all, by the way, in connection with the fact that Yosser was descended from Eli, and many years earlier, Hashem had sent Nevuos to Eli, first through Elkanah, then through Shmuel, that Eli and his family are going to be demoted from their position because of the way Eli's children, Chofni and Pinchas, had acted at the beginning of Sefer Shmuel. So now this started coming true many decades later, and that's why Tzadik, on the other hand, is descended from Pinchas, descended from Elazar and from Pinchas, and he's the one that the Kohen Gadol goes to him and continues in his family from then until the end. Anyway, the point is, the question is that why should the Kohen Gadol need Ruach HaKodesh in order to read what the Urim V'Tumim says? If we're saying the letters are boltus, they're sticking out, then anybody should be able to see it. If we're saying that they're mitzarfus, like Rish Lakish said, they actually move and combine to form a word, then anybody can read it. What do you need Ruach HaKodesh for? And the answer is Messiah Se'uri Ba'adayu. The answer is the Kohen Gadol's Ruach HaKodesh needs to work together with the Urim V'Tumim. If you have the Urim V'Tumim and the Kohen Gadol has the proper Ruach HaKodesh, then the letters will stick out and combine and do whatever they're supposed to do. If the Kohen Gadol does not have that degree of Ruach HaKodesh, then even though you have the Choshen, you have the Urim V'Tumim, and you have everything you need, but without his Ruach HaKodesh, it still won't work. The letters won't stick out or combine or do whatever they're supposed to do. So that's why you need Ruach HaKodesh, and then when Yosser didn't have it anymore, then they had to take away the right to ask the Urim V'Tumim from him and give it to Tzadik instead. Okay. Piskah, continuing, the Mishnah had said, V'ein Mish'on V'hem Lahed. You don't just have, no, a regular person can't ask the Urim V'Tumim, Elo L'melech, or L'beistin, or L'av Beistin, or L'mish Tzadik HaTzibur Boy, the king, the Av Beistin, or anybody whom the Tzibur needs, for example, a general. Is able to ask the Urim V'Tumim. So Menahani Mili, where do we know this from? Amar Rabba Bohu, Amar Kro, because the pasuk describes when Hashem tells Moshe to appoint Yeshua as the next leader of the Jewish people, Hashem tells him, "Lefnei Elazar Akoyin Yamid, Yeshua will stand in front of Elazar, v'shal loy v'gomer, and he'll ask him in with Mishpat Urim, which we said before, the Urim V'Tumim are called Mishpat because it's an irrevocable thing, and the pasuk says." The pasuk continues, they'll go out to war and they'll come back from war based on what he says. Who v'chol bnei Yisrael itay v'chol ha'eda. The pasuk says he, all of bnei Yisrael with him, and the whole eda, the whole congregation. So who is then melech? The word who refers to the king. The word v'chol bnei Yisrael itay is a mashuach melchama. When it says all the Jewish people with him, refers to the Mashuach Melchama, which is all the Jewish people go with him. When they're going to war, he goes with them. He's the one who gives the speeches. He's the one who gives the speeches telling who should go home and Shema Yisrael and all of that. So he's the one who has all the Jewish people with him. And the Chol Ha'eda is a Sanhedrin. And when it finishes off, in the whole Eda, we know in many places where the Eda that refers to the Sanhedrin, that's what it means over here. So the Sanhedrin, or particularly the Av Beis Din, who represents the Sanhedrin, is entitled to ask the Urim V'Tumim. HaKosef mentions over here one point, which is in parenthesis here in Rashi, you should read it based on a Gemara in Eruvin, that you can't ask the Urim V'Tumim for a Dvar Heter V'Issu. You can't ask it to give you a Psak Halacha, because Torah Lo B'Shamayim. So you're asking it whether should we go to war or whatever, what's going to happen next, but not when it comes to a matter of halacha, then you have to ask, the rabbi. Okay. Yom HaKippurim Perek Shmini. And then, by the way, the Ritva mentions one more point over here in connection with the Urim V'Tumim, which is something that the Rambam brings at the end of Hilchos Klei HaMikdash. You find various people in Tanakh who wore an ephod even though they weren't kohenim. We find Shmuel wearing one. We find David wearing one. So he brings from Tosfos, and then the Rambam says basically the same thing, that this was not the ephod with the Urim V'Tumim. It was a garment made similar to the ephod and of the Kohen Gadol, and it demonstrated that this person is on the mila of having Ruach HaKodesh like we just said the Kohen Gadol has to have. So it was like the uniform of the Balei Ruach HaKodesh then. And again, sometimes you do find in Tanakh, they also had ephods that were made as accessories for Avodah Zarah. We find one in Gideon's times, we find one in connection with Pesel Micha, but then you have the genuine one that the Kohen Gadol wore. Again, you have Rishonim that learned there were other genuine ones complete with Urim V'Tumim that other great people were able to wear and to use as well. And then you had an ephod like garment made out of linen, which Balei Ruach HaKodesh, for example, Shmuel and David wore. Yom HaKippurim Perek Shmini. This Perek now, the first seven Perekim, have talked all about the Avodah of the Kohen Gadol on Yom Kippur, which we don't have now until the Beis Hamikdash is built from Erev Yomenu. But the eighth Perek focuses on Yom Kippur as we do it in all times and all places. The fasting, the other Inuyim and so forth. So now, when you think about it, the Torah never says in so many words to fast on Yom Kippur. What it says is Ta'anu es nafshisechem. So the first thing we've got to establish is what does Ta'anu mean exactly? So that's Tonen Abon. We learn in a Braise. When it says Ta'anu es nafshisechem, when it says you should afflict your souls, Yochol Yeshu b'chamay b'tzina kadesh yitzar. Maybe that means that you have to sit in the heat or in the cold in order to feel uncomfortable. Talmud Lomar, no, because the pasuk continues v'chol melacha lo yisasu. The pasuk continues that also on Yom Kippur you're not allowed to do melacha. Ma malacha shev v'al taseh. So just like with malacha means something that you have to sit and not do it, something that the rest of the time you'd be doing. And now Hashem is telling you on Yom Kippur, don't do it. Af inu nefesh shev v'al taseh. The same way the inu nefesh has to be something passive. So it has to be something where you would have otherwise done something and now you're not going to. So if you go and sit in the heat or in the cold, then you're doing something. That's the opposite. So therefore, that's the opposite of not doing malacha. Well, the Gemara says, okay, but maybe it means if a person is already sitting in the sun at a time he's hot, we tell him, don't stay there, don't get up and sit in the shade. Yosef Betula, or if right now he's sitting in the shade, and he's feeling cold, we should tell him, don't get up and sit in the sun to warm up. So that would be a passive thing. That would be like staying away from Malacha. So maybe that's the inner Yom Kippur. And the answer is still Jumya de Malacha. It has to be completely similar to Malacha. Ma Malacha lechi lachdeva. When it comes to Malacha, there's never a distinction. Malacha is always doing something, and then not doing Malacha is always a passive thing, not doing something. Afinu lechachlekvay, the same way you can't have. In other words, if right now the person is sitting in the sun and he's uncomfortable, and you're going to tell him don't get out of this discomfort, but on the other hand, you may have another person who is already sitting in a comfortable place, and if we tell him go and sit in an uncomfortable place, then that's not the same as not doing malacha. Therefore, it has to be, of course, whatever the inui is, it has to be something that's going to be the same for everybody across the board, not depending on where you are at the beginning before you start the inui of Yom Kippur. Therefore, it can't mean anything about sun and shade and being uncomfortable like that. It has to be things that are described in the Torah as inui. So the Gemara goes on to deal with exactly how we learn that inui refers to the various chamisha, the chamisha inui of Yom Kippur. One point is the Gemara mentions in that connection a pasuk about the mon. Vayancha vayaribecha, that Hashem afflicted you and he made you hungry, and then he gave you the mon. So we learn from that being hungry is considered an inui. So now the Gemara goes into some agadah about that. The pasuk says Hashem gave you to eat mon in the midbar in order to afflict you. You have another pasuk that Hashem afflicted you and made you hungry. So the way we have it in front of us, the gusa would be that it's pointing out a contradiction between the two psukim. What is it? Was the eating the mon the affliction, or was the being hungry the affliction? Rashi, though, says that no, the correct gusa is, the Gemara is not pointing out a contradiction between the psukim. It's just explaining in what ways eating the mon, how can that be described as an inu? The fasting, the being hungry, fine, that's an inu, as we just said, and that's on Yom Kippur. But why should eating the mon be considered an inu? So Rav Ami and Rav Asi. So Rav Ami and Rav Asi argue what that pasuk means. One of them says, because you can't compare a person who has bread in his basket to a person who does not. Meaning, in other words, when you have, when a person has food for tomorrow, then when he eats today, he feels much more comfortable at it. Okay, I can eat whatever I want today, I still have more for tomorrow. When he doesn't, then he feels nervous about it. If I eat all my food today, I may not have any for tomorrow. With the mon, that was, they were doing that on a daily basis. Every single day, they have only food for that day, because of course they can't leave mon from one day over to the next. And therefore, in that sense, it's an inui, the fact that they're eating, but there's that constant worry, is there going to be mon tomorrow? Now later on, the sugya, the Gemara is going to explain, that is exactly why the Eivishta did that, in order to teach them that bitachon. There's a famous expression, a medrash, in fact, where Rabbi Eliezer says that even nowadays, if a person has what he needs for today, but not for any worries about what's going to be tomorrow, then he's mechose, he's miktane amone, he's one of the people who has less emunah than he should. So here, the Eivishta wanted to inculcate that into the Jewish people for 40 years straight, that's how a yid has to think. Ion Yaakov points out another point over here as well, that the purpose of eating the mon was to make them ready to receive the Torah, l'nitna Torah, l'oklei amon. And that's the kind of thing. When a person, when one of the aborim shmona dvarim, that the Torah is nitnas behem, as we say in Pirkei Avos, is miut tainug. So therefore, they just have to put them in a situation where they have less tainug in their eating than they otherwise would. No, well, they can't keep it for tomorrow, because after Justin and Avidim tried it the first time, it got wormy. But the point is, therefore, after that, everybody realized you have to eat it all today. You can't leave over for tomorrow. But as the Gemara points out later in the Sugya, Rav Shimon ben Yochai tells the Samidim, the fact is, everybody was constantly living on the edge. What about, so what happens if the Eivishta decides that mon shouldn't fall for us tomorrow? Then we're all going to starve. So that, but instead, that forced them to develop a bitachon in the Eivishta. There will be mon tomorrow. The Eivishta is not going to let us down. That's the tzar. The fact that every day they have to, they have that mental nervousness. Is there going to be mon tomorrow? And so that's how they develop their emunah. But to begin with, it is until a person develops that kind of skill, then it's a tzar. Therefore, Moshe can describe it at the end as vayamcha, as laman anisecha. So that's one point. Worth mentioning in that connection, by the way, Rashi mentions on a pasuk in Daniel, where they're saying a long tefillah to Hashem, remembering all the good things that Hashem had done for the Jewish people throughout history. They mention the point that you never held back your mon from them. Rashi over there brings, based on a medrash, what happened was when they made the eagle, they actually brought mon as a korban to the eagle. By rights, the Eidusha could have said, you know, you're misusing my mon, I'm not giving it to you tomorrow. And yet it still fell the next day. So the Eidusha never gave up on them, even at a time like that. Anyway, so that's one explanation. The other, between Rav Ami and Rav Asi, says another point as well. There's a big difference whether you see what you're eating versus you don't see it. The mon, the Gemara is going to discuss later on, different opinions. According to one, we know the mon could taste like almost anything you wanted, but according to one man de omer, it wouldn't look like it. It would look just like the way it describes it in the pasuk, as this fine, flaky stuff. It would taste like whatever you wanted, so therefore you're not getting the enjoyment, you're not getting the full enjoyment of being able to see the juicy steak or whatever it is that you're eating. So in that sense, it can be called an inu. Yeah. Rav Yosef, mikan remes l'sumen, shoruchon vein and svein. And Rav Yosef says, here you have a hint that blind people, they eat, but they're never fully satisfied. Rav Yosef himself was blind, so he knew what he had his own experience to draw on, because he can't see what he's eating. And Amr Rav Zera, my kra, what's a posik that expresses that point? Posik in Tehelis, toiv mar einayim mehaloch nefesh. Better the seeing of the eyes than the way that a person goes with his desires. Nefesh sometimes means a desire. So in other words, you have a person has a desire for something, has a taiva for something, but even better is to be able to see it. When he's not able to see it, then he lacks the full pleasure of it. And Oman Abaya, Hilkach, Manda, Islay, Sodasa, based on this, then if a person has a Soda, Loy Mechle, Elabi Mama, then he should eat it only by day for the same reason. If he eats it by night, he's not gonna fully enjoy it. Now, to be sure, later on, the Gemara points out in the Sugya, it is fine even by night if he eats it by candlelight, because then at least you can see what he's eating. And for that matter, of course, a person can eat and be satisfied by night. After all, we have a Seder by night, and when there's a Korban Pesach, then you eat it a la Soiva. So it's not like it's impossible to get filled up by night, but in other words, you'd still get more pleasure of it if you're actually able to see what you're eating. And Ion Yaakov mentions in this connection, there's a medrash that brings from this pasuk by Ya'ancha by Yarivecha by Yaakovcha Saman, you have a hint to that, to the concept of Neiros Shabbos Kodesh. Same idea, because if you're eating, you're still down Shabbos and you don't have candlelight, you don't have light to eat it by, you're not going to have such enjoyment of it. So therefore, that's again, the Eidosh to put them through this experience where they're not going to fully enjoy it in order that this way, again, they have the mere Tainug that leads them being able to be roary to receive the Torah. Rish Lakish gives a different explanation in this pasuk that we quoted, this half pasuk that we quoted, Toiv Mare Enayim, Mahaloch Nafesh. It also means Toiv Mare Enayim Beisha Yosem Gufa Shal Oisem Maisa. Seeing the beauty of a woman is sometimes better for a person. He has more pleasure from it than the actual Maisa of Znus with her. Shenema Toiv Mare Enayim, Mahaloch Nafesh. So, in other words, and there's a few points in it. For one thing, the actual mice itself weakens a person, whereas the sight of it does not. But for that reason, the Gemara mentions earlier in the Masechta, precisely for that reason, Hirhure Avera, Koshin Avera, sometimes the Hirhur is worse than the actual mice for a number of reasons, and one of them is like what I was saying over here, because Itaka has greater Hana from it. There's other points that we talked about over there, because a person doesn't think that Hirhur is such a serious thing. But in any case, the point is that Shloima is telling you should know you get in a way a person can get greater hana from the seeing than from the doing. Yom Yom Mashiach Gola. We started talking about yesterday that Rebbe was talking in a sicha about even though we say Ein Yisrael Negolim Ela B'Tshuva, Ein Adar B'Tola Ela B'Tshuva, there are reasons why to say that even if we don't see that actually happening, that won't hold back the Geula. The first one we learned yesterday, because inevitably every Yid has had a Hirur Tshuva several times in his life. And the second reason is because nowadays people are not keeping a Torah and Mitzvahs, are Tenokas Shenishvu, they're Onus, Onus Rachmana Patrei. On the other hand, when those Tanokas Shanishbu keep even one mitzvah, then it's very precious to the Eibishter. And in our generation, we take to see how tens of thousands of Tanokas Shanishbu have returned and continue to return to Darchei HaTorah, and therefore that's a much more precious thing. So there really is Tshuva going on a constant basis. Yeah, by the way, there was just a video clip going around of some member of the Knesset giving a whole speech over there saying that she used to think that Mashiach is the Oslo Accords and the this and the that political thing, and now she realizes there really is only the true Mashiach, and that's what we believe in, and that's what we're looking at, and he's the one we're looking forward to. So there really is an enormous movement of tshuva going on right now among many people who had no shaisas to it before. So that's what the Rebbe is saying over here. Therefore, even if you think there are all those people, not yet, but you should realize that's not going to be ma'akev the geula. The geula amidas v'ashlema will come based on how things are right now. Miad
Marish. This is right before the geula now.
Okay, continuing on halachas of davening on Shabbos, we talked about yesterday the halacha that if a person starts weekday Shemana Esrei on Shabbos or Yom Tov, he has to finish the bracha that he was in the middle of. So what happens? A person says one word of the bracha, then he's going to have to finish that bracha as well, with the exception of atachoyne. Now, if you only said Atta, the fact is, in most of the tefillos of Shabbos, the first bracha, the middle bracha also begins Atta. Atta Kidashta and Atta Echon. So in Ma'ariv or in Mincha, even if he said Atta, intending to say Atta Choinen, he doesn't need to continue Choinen, he can continue Kidashta or Echad as the case may be. If that happens by Shachos, then it depends. Since the bracha by Shachos doesn't begin Atta, it begins Yismach Moshe, then it depends. If he did it because Tate, he was thinking that it was weekday, then he has to finish Atta Choinen because now he doesn't have the excuse of saying that the Atta is part of the bracha of Shabbos. But if he knew that it was Shabbos, he's used to saying after at this point, after Akela Kodesh, and therefore he said after, then he can continue Yismach Moshe from there. Because after all, it's only considered an effect, like he made a bracha from one, like he made a mistake from one tefillah to another. The same way, for example, as if Friday night a person gets that bracha and starts saying Yismach Moshe and says the whole bracha, but the Yevid, he doesn't have to go back. The same way by Shachas, if he starts saying Ata Kidashka or Ata Echad or whatever, he doesn't have to go back. To that extent, the brachas are considered interchangeable. Similarly to here, when he said Ata, not because he thought it was a weekday, but Stam because he's used to saying Ata, then he's allowed to continue the bracha Yismach Moshe without having to say Ata. And then, if he only remembers till he got to Ritzay, then he has to break off wherever he remembered and start over with the Shabbos or Yom Tov Bracha and finish the Seder. If he only realizes by the time he gets to Yul HaRotzen, then he has to daven all over again. Because then he didn't mention Shabbos in davening at all.